everybody, and welcome to Geek Actually Tech Episode 4 for the 3rd of March 2010. I was trying to introduce the show, and my mic was still turned off. Go figure. All right, so here we are again for our hour of tech goodness. First of all, let me just say that my name is David McVeigh, and I am joined in studio by Shane Gregory. How are you, Shane? Yeah.
Very good.
Unfortunately, Josh won't be with us tonight. He was called away to an event, a Final Fantasy 13. Was it launch event or something like that?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, so yeah, he's gone to where gamer geeks go.
Yeah.
So. But we have a few more people in our chat room this week, which is kind of nice. Last week, we were kind of flying a little bit quiet. We only had one in our chat room last week. I suspect the Winter Olympics had a lot of people doing what they were doing. But, you know, what can you do? All right, so for those who haven't listened before, this show is basically accessible tech for the tech and non-tech alike. We basically chit-chat for the next hour or so. We do a few news stories, and then we have a topic of the week. And this week, we are discussing the tech of 3D cinema, which is kind of interesting, I think, Shane, because it's so popular at the moment that they are now starting to turn around and say, these movies are being converted into 3D and everything has to be in 3D. And there was an article just today in the paper that I saw from Martin Scorsese, the renowned filmmaker, who is now saying that he thinks all films should be in 3D.
Yeah.
And you sit there and go, you? You et tu, Brute? Anyway, so I think it was about time that maybe we talk about how it actually works. What is 3D? What is the future of it? And where does it come from? What is the history of 3D? And so we'll come to that a little bit later in the show. Yeah. But first off, we do have a little bit of follow-up to last week's show. We try and always try and have a little bit of follow-up to the last week's show. In this case, unfortunately, Shane wasn't here last week, but we did a story last week. It was actually our main topic of the week, which was all about privacy. And one of the stories that actually led this off was a school district in Philadelphia that was using spy software on all the laptops, and a student was basically suing the school because photos had been taken in his bedroom of him doing something bad, blah. Anyway, the follow-up to that is that it has gone to preliminary court, and according to this, as somebody said in the article on CNET, you know you've made it when you get the suffix of gate at the end of something. They're now calling this webcam gate.
Oh.
Webcam gate, which is kind of awkward to say, but webcam gate. Basically, the judge, a federal judge, has made a very clear statement that all webcams need to, all access to webcams must cease immediately and under no circumstances is any of the software permitted to be turned on or activated at any time until this is settled. And he has also basically come down and said that all data, now this is the part that I thought was interesting, where he actually said the judge also ordered the school to preserve all electronic data, files, and storage media that pertain to the plaintiff's claims. And the school district has agreed not to touch anything. So basically they want to be able to scan those hard drives to see exactly what was taken, what was done, what was seen, what activation dates. And they know, and the judge is clever because he knows that it's very quick. In the old days, it would have been shredding the documents. Nowadays, it's formatting hard drives, right?
Yeah.
The other telling piece on this was basically that emails that this reporter at CNET has received since this all happened is that other school districts seem to be getting a little bit nervous. So the question comes up, how many other school districts have this kind of software in place?
Yeah.
And are they all starting to get a little bit nervous about what is going on with all this? So I think it's a very interesting thing. We are going to keep this, as we said last week, we will keep updating on this every time we hear something. But yes, an injunction has come down, and the judge is taking it very, very, very seriously. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. No word as to yet as to what the FBI has uncovered, because the FBI was also called in because there was talk that there may be pedophile issues.
Like with the original story, did they find where the actual software was embedded? Like, was it?
It's actually a program.
System?
It's an off-the-shelf program.
So it's a program that's actually running.
Yeah.
So would their antivirus be able to pick up that program?
No, because it's not actually a virus. That's the problem. You can actually buy this sort of software off the shelf. I actually, before last week's show, I actually went online, and I actually had a looked around. And yes, there are many various packages that you can buy for Macs, because these were Apples, that will actually allow you to remotely activate the camera.
Because I know that a lot of the the new antivirus software companies actually have a viral scanner or a program blocker that actually can stop running specific programs or programs that it feels are a threat to the actual
system. Yeah, but if the program isn't an authorized piece of software, no antivirus or anything will find it as a threat because it's an authorized piece of software. Mm. It's just icky. The whole story is just icky from beginning to end. You know, it's one of those things where after you read this sort of story, after last week's show, I felt like going to give me a shower, you know? It's just kind of like, yeesh. Yeah. All right, so that was our follow-up to last week. We do have a little bit of news before we kick off with our 3D spectacular. I feel like we're unveiling Avatar or something. We do have a little bit of news that we will cover really quickly. What have you been up to for a week, by the way? Because you weren't here last week. You got anything to report in? How's the world of PC on your side?
No, it's been going well for me. Obviously, I'm still on holiday at the moment, and my family's very happy that I'm a part of this podcast here. And
yeah, you're going to try and get your mum to check in, aren't you?
Yeah. Mum's going to try and download and watch the show.
Cool. I was actually saying to Shane before the show started, I was saying, and this is the one show that she actually could watch.
Yeah.
This is the only one that I think is actually safe. How about Geek Actually in 3D? Yeah, you buy the technology, we'll do it. No problem.
Yeah.
All right. So our chat room's very active about the 3D thing. Yeah, but, all right. Okie dokie. So on to news. First thing, this is localized to Australia. Prime Minister Kevin Rudd basically says that he won't apologize for the internet filter. Now, I'm sorry, this article came up from our fan page, actually. PopShot put this up in the fan page. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I better have a look at that. And I looked at it and I thought, yeah, okay, we'll put that in the show. But it's very interesting because he actually doesn't really say anything. He kind of says something and he kind of doesn't say something. So basically what happened was, while he was doing Channel 7 Sunrise program, he was asked by viewers why the government was going to implement a plan that basically, he claimed, would fail in its objective to protect children. I mean, it's a valid question. Yeah. You know, why are we implementing the internet censorship filter when we already know it's doomed to failure? And before the chat room jumps in and says, why is it doomed to failure? Let me just inform you. They have already stated from the very beginning that it will not filter news groups or peer-to-peer.
Yeah.
Now, I got to tell you, most child pornography is not on the open web. When was the last time you just happened to stumble across child pornography? It doesn't happen, all right? Where you find child pornography, I'm assuming, I don't go looking for it, please, but this is what I've been told, is you find it in places in the seedier side of the internet. You find it in peer-to-peer share networks. You find it in the news groups and so forth. And these aren't being monitored.
Yeah.
What they're putting a filter on is the web. Mm. And the web, I'm sorry, isn't that dangerous. In my opinion, in my opinion, it's not that dangerous. Anyway, so I think it's a valid question. We know it's doomed for failure.
Yeah.
And he actually said, this is Kevin Rudd's quote, he says, in response, Rudd pointed to the refused classification material in the filter, and his quote was, what does it involve? Acts of child abuse, acts of sexual abuse against children, including material, would also provides how-to kits in terms of conducting terrorist acts. I think this stuff is filthy. I can't stand it. I think these are the right measures. You're running a business. We're pro-internet, but we don't make apologies for this. All right. So basically he's saying, I think it's icky, so therefore I think it should go, imposing his moral beliefs on the entire nation.
Yeah.
And that's my kind of big issue with all this. What do you think, Shane?
Yeah, I mean, he's trying to speak for everyone, isn't he?
Well, he's our elected official, I guess.
As far as the internet's concerned, I mean, what does this guy do on the internet to begin with? Does he just come in and check his bank balance and walk away?
Bagmup in our chat room has actually asked a really, 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 really interesting question, and I actually have an answer to that. Bagmup has actually said in our chat room, I want to know, will the filter slow our already snail-paced internet even more? Ha! I actually have an answer to that. I don't think it's an accurate answer, but it's what he said. This is once again a quote from our Prime Minister Rudd, who says, where is it? He said about the filtering, which will be carried out by the internet service providers, slowed the speed slowed the speed of web surfing, but only to the equivalent to 1/70th of the blink of an eye. Okay. Now, I have a couple questions on that. I have a couple questions. First of all, who's blinking? Yeah. All right, so we have to calculate that, first of all, because, you know, blinking is different. No, but my question is this. Slowed what to 1/70th of a blink of an eye? A packet?
Yeah.
A kilobit? Mm. A megabit? What did it slow to 1/70th of a blink of an eye? Because if it's just a packet, then you got to then start doing some math and start calculating how many thousands of packets or how many millions of packets, multiply each one of those by 1/70th, and you start, it's that whole argument of the movie Office Space where they say we're stealing a tenth of a cent, and after time that 1/10 of a cent adds up, right? Yeah. It's the same thing with this. 1/70th multiplied by however many packets are being delivered will add up.
Yeah.
If you're putting over millions of packets of information, then you got to ask yourself, well, that 1/70th is no longer. It's going to get into whole numbers real quick, you know? So I think your answer, Bagmup, is yes, it does. Yeah, what the hell does that even mean? Yeah, that is exactly my point. Yeah. No, so in other words, they don't know. And the other thing about this test, all right, the other thing that needs to be made very, very, very clear straight off the bat is that when they did the trials, I'm going to use air quotes, when they did the trials, which none of the major ISPs were involved in, all right, they basically controlled the trial to such a point where they only used minor ISPs. They only used several. They only, I think it was only like 8 or 9 or something like that that they actually used. They doomed the test to failure before they even started. Basically, they set it up so that the figures would be skewed. We don't know how much it will slow the internet down by, because it's never been tested on a network like Telstra or IINet or Optus, or even a network like TPG, which isn't even one of the big ones, but it hasn't been tested on these big networks. So we don't know. Yeah. The suspicion by analysts is, yes, if it has to calculate and scan every packet of data coming in, looking for material, by default, that means it's going to slow down. And the analogy that I would bring up is, put Norton antivirus onto your computer, turn it off, and start your computer, okay? And watch how fast it boots, right? Then turn it on and reboot your computer.
Yeah.
And then watch how fast it boots, all right? All right? When you have an antivirus like Norton's on, which is a big, heavy antivirus, your boot time slows down by a matter of seconds. I mean, it really does drag it right down because it has to scan all the boot sectors as it's starting up. The internet censorship filter is going to be like that. Yes, it will be fast, but it's still going to be a drag. And as Bagmup has so eloquently pointed out in our chat room, we have as slow as a snail internet to start with when you compare it to the rest of the world. You know, I've been trying to find, just as a side note, I've been trying to find to put a second line in here for the feed. And I've been thinking, well, we could put a cable line in, or we could put another ADSL line in, trying to find a decent speed, low enough cost line to put in here is virtually impossible. It's ridiculous. Our internet is screwed at the moment. Excuse my language, but our internet is screwed. And this filter will not help it.
No.
All right, any more on that before we move on? Game was a mess, and NZ is worse. What? Psydog. NZ is worse? Really? Is that about the same thing, or are you talking about something else? You guys go off on tangents. I can never tell. All right, we'll move on while you come back to that, because we have about a 20-second delay. Okay, now the interesting part to the whole internet censorship filter, the plot thickens. This is related, is that Senator Kate Lundy, who is a Labor senator, part of the Rudd government, has basically turned around. This was also given to us in our fan page. Now, if you guys have stories that you want us to cover, please put it into facebook.com/geekactually. Put it in the fan page. We'll have a look at it. This came in. Kate Lundy, the Australian reports, has basically turned around and said, her quote, "The feedback I'm getting from my colleagues is that there are concerns around freedom of speech and the lack of parental empowerment." Really? You think so? Yeah. I'm sorry. Really, this only just occurred to you. Anyway, so she's basically saying that she is not for the internet censorship filter as it stands at the moment, and she basically is proposing a filter opt-out. Now, What this means is that the filter would still go into effect, but you, the user, basically have the option to say, I don't want to be filtered.
Yeah.
Okay? And I think that is brilliant because if you actually look at your research around the world, we actually have, I think it's 11 countries or something that actually offer a blanket internet filter like the one they're proposing here, and they're all opt out.
Yeah.
So basically, if you don't want to be capped, if you don't want to be scanned and so forth, you can opt out. It's a freedom issue. Mm. And she's basically saying that, okay, we may not be able to stop this, but it should be at least opt out.
I mean, if it was an optional thing to be filtered or not, it would be more beneficial if that was for, like, the parents. Obviously, it'd be better suited for
them. Well, and this is the thing. If it is to protect the children, that it should be the parents' choice, you know? Mm. Somebody in the chat room, Bagmup, has just put in the chat room, he says, if I could opt out, I wouldn't mind if ASIO kept tabs on me. Because it's true. I mean, that is a factor. If you opt out of the internet censorship filter, they're going to start watching you very closely because they're going to say, why did you opt out? Because obviously, the fact that you like privacy means you're a criminal, right?
Yeah.
I'm being sarcastic, people. But, you know, so, yeah, I understand. But you know what? It's actually not so bad. Just as a point of reference on all this, my family was actually under FBI investigation for many years when I was a baby because we lived in America and we lived in a fairly poor neighborhood. And my grandparents kept saying, we're going back to Australia. And they kept booking tickets to go back to Australia and then canceling. And then booking tickets to go back to Australia and canceling. And this aroused suspicion of the FBI trying to figure out what the hell was going on at this house. They actually had our house being staked out at one point. So, yeah, I know what it's like to be under the scrutiny of the federal government. But, you know, unless they find something on you, they're not going to bother you. If, you know, you opt out and then you don't do something stupid, they're not going to come after you for anything. So we won't go into that whole issue that Google said, which, of course, is that if you aren't doing anything wrong, then you've got nothing to fear about privacy. It's like, no, that's not right at all. I'm sorry. That's completely the wrong philosophy. Anyway, we shall move on. We're rambling on for no apparent reason here. All right. Shane, any comments on the internet censorship filter before we move on?
It just seems that the government just can't make up its mind.
Oh, I think they've made up their mind.
Everybody's got their own opinion.
I think Kevin Rudd and Senator Conroy have made up their mind. Mm. I think we've got a few backbenchers who are now basically saying, you know, because the problem is, I mean, basically the bottom line is they have to listen to the constituents. They have to listen to the people who voted them in.
Mm.
And I think what's happening is that there is movement from the backbench senators who are now saying, you know what, some of the people aren't really happy with this.
Mm.
But as we said before, they can't just put one of these in. This issue is going before the caucus in the next few weeks. It's going to be backwards and forwards and argued and so forth for the next few weeks. But I don't think, I'm pretty sure about this, they can't do this. They can't instigate this without taking it to election.
Mm.
So I think it will happen because we're just kind of that messed up at the moment. But
I think that these party members also need to put a bit more research into this as well. It's not like...
Yeah.
Put a bit more thought into it instead of just like a paper comes into your desk and it's like stamp, yes, next.
Yeah. Did I tell you my prediction? I made a prediction. I laid down a prediction to Josh, actually. And I'll put that prediction because I don't think I've done it on air. I was talking to Josh, and somebody's actually mentioned this is as nuts as the 18-plus debate. And this, my prediction is actually about that. So let's see what the chat room thinks of this. This is my prediction. I follow politics pretty closely. And I was thinking about this the other day and I thought, do you know what? I think, personally, the R18+ rating is a smokescreen.
Yeah.
I think that this has been on the cards for so long, and people have been talking about this for so long and rejecting it for so long. Mm. Why was the discussion paper brought up now? Mm. Why is all this conversation happening about it now? Right? Yeah. It is because they know everybody is pissed off about the internet censorship filter.
Yeah.
Okay? My suspicion is they're putting all this energy into the R rating plus, the R 18 plus rating to keep people's minds off the internet censorship filter. Mm. And my prediction is we will get the R 18 plus rating by the end of the year, right around the time that we'll be going to election on the internet censorship filter, and while everybody is going, yay, we've got an R18 plus, they're going to slide that internet censorship filter in under the mat because everybody's already happy that they got the R18. Because the R18 plus is a much easier thing for them to swallow than not doing the internet censorship filter. So I think that's a smokescreen, and I think they're using you gamers to get the geek, or using the geeks, us geeks, gamers, everybody, they're using us to basically slide their internet censorship filter in under the radar. What do you guys think of that one? And that's my call. I think that's old age does such things. What? Anyway, so yeah, that's what side note, because I can't repeat the words because we're trying to carry a clean thing. But what the F are your Aussie politicians smoking? I agree with you completely. Now, for the listening audience who may be, this may be their first show, Psydog is actually from New Zealand, and they have an R18 plus rating. Yeah. So yes, no, it's crazy. And Bagmup says he thinks I'm right. There you go. Anyway, I could be completely wrong about this. I could be completely misreading this, but that's my call. And now it's on record. And in a few months' time, we'll be able to play this one back and say, man, you're an idiot. Now, I got to read you this story. Let's get off politics for a minute and do something funny. Because I got to read you this. And I titled this story in the show notes, when is a story about the Apple iPad not a story about the Apple iPad? And I want to read... I'm tempted to read the whole article to you, but I'm not going to. But I'm just going to read some key choice moments, okay? Because I want you to just tell me what you think is wrong with this, right? This was actually in the Sydney Morning Herald. Excuse me. This was in the Sydney Morning Herald, and it actually titled, Apple iPad Launch May Be Delayed, written by an analyst, okay? And these are the key points that I thought I'd read to you. Apple may delay or limit the size of the launch of its anticipated iPad tablet computer, blah, 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 because an unspecified production problem, blah, 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 blah. My second, Apple's Taiwan-based supplier, Honhai Precision, could be facing a production bottleneck or a shortage of components, blah, 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 blah. An unspecified production problem with the iPad manufacturer, blah, 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 will likely limit the launch region, blah, 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 blah. The delay in production ramp will likely impact Apple's April unit estimate, blah, blah, blah. And then it goes on and says, the only material impact for the iPad delay could come in the form of frustrated customers, blah, blah, blah. All right, what do we see wrong with this? This is a story that has no basis in any kind of fact whatsoever.
It's just ranting.
I actually calculated it, and it has one may, two unspecified, two coulds, and two likelies. Not a solid fact at all. The only solid fact is this line. Apple has not publicly stated an official release date or how many models it is expecting to put on sale. Period.
Yeah.
Apple hasn't said anything.
Yeah,
all
no
right.
Comment
so
Apple.
Basically, I just love this article because it's all coulds, maybes, unspecified, you know, using recently undiscovered evidence. You know, it's complete nonsense. And you sit there and go, what? What? Why is this even in the newspaper?
Yeah.
And then you could argue, why is it even on this show? Ah, because we're reading it off the newspaper.
That might have been better if this person actually got an Apple representative to actually say that.
Yeah, it actually says here, it says, messages left for Apple were not immediately returned.
Yeah. Of course they're not going to comment about it.
So, Sydney Morning Herald, all I can say to you is, come on, can we have some real reporting? I just think that is one of the funniest stories. Because somebody actually sent that to me. Oh, my wife actually told me about it. My wife told me about it and said, you've got to read, it just looks like the Apple iPad might be delayed. Mm. She goes, I haven't read the article yet, I just saw the headline. Mm. Jumped on the computer, brought up the website, and I was reading going, now wait a minute. So anyway. All right. Now, from silly to the creepy, this is probably the creepiest thing I've actually read in quite some time. You know those really realistic Japanese robot girls that they make, which are supposed to be like your perfect girlfriends, and they look really realistic, and they talk to you, and they're really, really creepy as they are? Well, I had an idea because this article came up in Crave that basically says that a company, a British material firm, Piratech, has developed artificial electronic skin.
Oh.
Creepy. It says it's for robots at MIT's Media Lab. And basically it says that when touched, they'll know what degree and pressure they've been touched. So you could tickle, backslap, or caress your favorite robot. Oh, it's getting creepier by the minute. It says, made of spiky metallic nanoparticles and silicon rubber, QTC, the skin, works by changing from an insulator to a conductor when pressure is applied. And all I can think is, as soon as I read this, they don't mention those Japanese robots. Let me make that clear. But as soon as I read this, I'm going, Japanese realistic robots? Real skin that knows when it's being tickled and touched. Oh dear. Creepy. Bagma. No. Naughty Bagma. He says, watch the grip there, baby.
They could have an army of them coming out of the manufacturer holding machine guns, and then all these little kids running up and trying to hug them, and then it's like, get away before I wish.
Did you guys ever see Star Trek First Contact? The one with the Borg. And where the Borg Queen puts the artificial skin on Data, and she blows on it, and all the hairs stand up. Yeah. It's like, that's what you... Skynet, I tell you, Skynet is just a little bit closer. All right, it's just a little bit closer. I just, you know, it's funny how my mind works. I read about robot skin, and I think of Japanese love dolls. So, I don't know. I don't know where my mind goes somewhere. Now... this next article, and we're almost at the end of news here, but this next article I love because I actually didn't care about the article at all. If you notice in the show notes, I said, just read the last paragraph. Mm. We all know that Google is trying to take over the world, or to some degree. And this week, Google purchased the photo editing site Picnic, P-I-C-N-I-K. Basically, it's photo editing tools in the cloud. Now, one could assume that they're trying to compete with Flickr. And this is what Google does. Yeah. Picnic is actually one step up on Flickr, though, because it actually has editing tools. It's not just a display, but it also does display your photos. Goes on about how much they bought it for and blah, blah, blah. But the last paragraph is the one that got me on this article from news.com.au, which just says, Google chief executive Eric Schmidt said the company planned to acquire about one company a month this year. I'm sorry, pardon? And is that every year? Are we going to just keep buying companies? It's like Google seems to be wanting to buy every company on the face of the planet. So, okay, good for them. But it really does sound like Google is marching forward on its bid to take over the world. So any Picnic users out there, I've never actually used the service, but it makes me curious. Chat room can chime in on that one. Now, this is just a little tidbit of information, basically, that says that the iPhone LED... Now, a lot of people, now including my old co-host on the Geek Actually show, for those who are long-term listeners, Jacob Oberman, was so excited about OLED. And basically how OLED was the game changer. This was going to be the way of the future. OLED was everything. It was going to make everything different. Well, it's interesting because the Nexus One and the Droid phones both have OLED screens on them, and somebody was basically saying, why hasn't the iPhone got OLED? Maybe it's time that they upgrade to OLED and so forth. Well, a study came out, a company called DisplayMate have done a side-by-side comparison test of the Nexus One OLED and the iPhone's backlit LED screen, and the clear winner is the iPhone's backlit LED screen. And it's really amazing. They've actually got photos. The link for this article will be on the show notes for this episode. Go have a look at the photos. They actually have photos of the screen and the banding. Banding is when you get those lines of color rather than smooth transition. The banding on the OLED screen is phenomenal. There's a grayscale image, and basically you can see all this banding. They're saying that the iPhone displayed the image exactly the same way as on the monitor. Whereas the Nexus One did not, and there's a lot of work to be done on these OLED screens. So I'm sure it's brighter, because OLED is very bright, but resolution-wise, it looks like backlit LED, especially the iPhone's backlit LED, is still a clear winner over the Nexus One and the Droid. So very interesting article, because sometimes the new technology is not always the better technology, as we'll find out in 3D. All right, so that's basically news for the day. Anything to add or change or amend or comments, Shane? Nothing?
No, I've got nothing to add.
All right, cool. Well, then we're going to move ourselves into our topic of the week. Our topic of the week this week, of course, is the tech of 3D cinema. And I have been doing my homework. I got to tell you, I've been doing my homework. And I thought what we'd do first is we would do a Very, very quick. It says Google will never get Apple. Yeah. Never say never, dude. Eric Schmidt used to be on the board of director of Apple. Sorry, just talking to the chat room again. All right, so what I thought we'd do here is we'd just start with a brief history of 3D cinema, because, you know, we do actually have a lot of people in our audience who are in their 20s who may not have actually experienced much 3D until this latest revolution and may not realize that this is actually nothing new in many ways and very new in some ways. So basically, if we look back over the history of 3D cinema, we can actually see that the earliest 3D dates back to the 1920s. When they first started toying around with the idea of stereoscopic vision. Yeah. And basically, when you think about it, 3D is not really 3D. 3D is two dimensions, and it's what's called persistence of vision. It's the same thing that makes stop-motion animation work. It's tricking the eye into thinking it's seeing something that it's not, right? So all we're doing with 3D is we're basically, by manipulating the fields of our vision, we are making ourselves think we're seeing depth when we're not really seeing depth.
Yeah.
All right. The earliest 3D dates back to the 1920s, and interestingly enough, the polarizing technique that we use today, and this was the part that blew my mind, because I was actually unaware of this until we started doing research, but the polarizing technique that we use today actually goes back to the 1930s. And everybody talked about this new polarizing technique and how amazing this new polarizing technique was. It's so much better than the red and blue glasses, which we'll come back to in a minute. But really, those red and blue glasses actually weren't used that much. And we'll actually talk about that in just a minute. Once again, it's an Australia thing. Yeah. All right. It's arguably the 1950s that really made the 3D gimmick of choice by Hollywood studios. They called it the golden era of 3D. And between 1952 and 1955, we had many, many, many films come out in 3D, including seminal classics House of Wax, Dial M for Murder, which, of course, is the only film Alfred Hitchcock ever shot in 3D, Creature from the Black Lagoon, and It Came from Outer Space, plus many, many, many others. Like today, these films were originally released using the polarized lenses. Yeah. So if you've ever seen any of these films in re-release, I've seen a couple of these at, like, you know, the Astor Theater in Melbourne and so forth, we used the red and blue lenses. And, yeah, it was kind of fun watching these old films in 3D, but you go, boy, we've come so far from then. When those films were originally projected in the 1950s, they would have looked as good as things like Avatar. Well, maybe not quite as good, but it would have looked similar to something like Avatar because they were using the polarized lenses. And we'll come back to the tech of that in a minute and how the changes between then and now. In the 1980s, we had a resurgence of 3D. Well, actually, throughout the 70s, we were kind of doing short films, documentaries, theme park rides. They kept playing with the technique. But it was the 1980s that we had a real resurgence of 3D. And this is kind of my era of film, guys. Mm-hmm. I remember when all of these were at the cinema. And in fact, I saw several of them. But we had films like Amityville 3D, Coming At You, Friday the 13th Part 3D, Jaws 3D, Metal Storm, Space Hunter, etc., etc. The revival was short-lived. It was only 1980 to 1984, and basically they stopped making 3D films again. They basically went, gimmick's over. I got to say, one of the problems with 3D films in the 80s was that 90% of the films were awful.
Yeah.
It wasn't the 3D that was the problem. It was the fact that the films were awful, you know? Anyway, and that's what's kind of changed now, is that we're putting it to slightly better films. Mainstream cinema kind of dropped 3D at this point, but IMAX wasn't finished. And it was IMAX that kind of led the charge at this point, because IMAX continued pursuing 3D. They were using the polarized lenses. They were using IMAX two-strip film process, and they kept releasing documentaries and stuff like that in this IMAX 3D format. Yeah. And it kept the format alive. And long enough, it kept the format alive that James Cameron got involved. And now we come to our 3D revolution of today. Basically, 3D of today is made possible by high-def video. High-def photography, James Cameron went to IMAX and basically said, I want to make a documentary, and I want to shoot it in 3D, and I want to use high-def cameras. Yeah. And he commissioned a company to design and build the cameras for him. And IMAX invested in digital projection technology, which, once again, James Cameron was instrumental in helping design the entire concept of bringing it away from film and putting it onto digital. And the digital was the big big changing point here. Yeah. And we'll talk about that in tech as to how that became the big changing point. But in the meantime, he made two documentaries in 3D, Ghosts of the Abyss in 2003 and Aliens of the Deep in 2005. And Robert Rodriguez, the filmmaker, took the same cameras that that Cameron had invented and shot Spy Kids 3D in 2003 and The Adventures of Sharkboy and Lavagirl in 2005. This kind of started kicking off a bit of an interest in 3D at this point. It wasn't really until 2004, though. 2004 was a watershed year in the world of 3D because we had Robert Zemeckis' The Polar Express come out. Yeah. The most amazing part of this was that 3D films never made much money. They were a gimmick. That was as simple as that. However, Polar Express came out in 3,584 standard 2D cinemas. So just normal projection screens, and 66 IMAX screens showing it in 3D. 25% of its revenue came from the IMAX 3D screen. Suddenly everybody wanted to see it in 3D. And at that point, the studios took note, the studios were interested, and they decided that they were going to start releasing more films in digital 3D. A more reasonable format was created for standard cinemas, and cinemas started to retool. And once again, we'll talk about in the tech part about how they had to retool for projecting these films. Once these were actually done, we now have, at this point, several major feature films coming out in 3D, and we also have lots of films basically being now restructured to be 3D when they weren't even shot that way. Yeah. They're being what's called 3D converted. The prime example of this is the last Harry Potter film and Clash of the Titans. These are both being currently reconverted to 3D as we speak.
And they even said recently that Alice in Wonderland got shot in 2D and actually converted to 3D.
Yeah, but Alice in Wonderland is actually kind of an interesting one because about 75% of the film is digital.
Yeah.
That doesn't actually have to be converted. When it comes to 3D modeling, digital cinema, when you're creating stuff in a computer, it's actually very easy to turn that into 3D because all you have to do is create a secondary virtual camera and re-render. Using the stereoscopic cameras. But all the live-action stuff he shot with straight standard high-def cameras and then 3D converted those to match the special effects that was being made in 3D because it was actually easier than having to worry about stereoscopic vision on those lenses. There is actually argument both ways as to what works better, shooting in 3D or 3D conversion. We have some information about that as well. We'll have a look at that. But yes, it was always meant to be digital 3D, but he decided to shoot it in 2D. What's also interesting is James Cameron, although he shot the film in 3D, he actually says that when he shot Avatar, he shot it as a 2D film. So all of his framing, all of his camera angles, and everything else was exactly the same as if he was making a two-dimensional, straight standard film. He said that he did that for a purpose. He said because he felt at the time 90% of the viewing audience would probably see it in standard 2D theaters.
Yeah.
How wrong he was. Absolutely how wrong he was. Anyway, all right, so that's basically your little history. The history lesson ends with, is 3D here to stay? Well, let me ask you a question. When a film like Avatar hits the cinema and actually goes on to make $2.5 billion at the box office, do you think the studios are going to say, no, I think it's a flash in the pan, let's not do any more?
Yeah.
I think the studios are going to look at that and go, I think every single movie should be in 3D. Unfortunately, not every single movie is going to be Avatar, and they have to be aware of that. Yeah. All right, so Shane, how does it work? How does it work? All right, first of all, what are the different formats? Because at the moment, if you go to the cinema, there are a couple of competing formats. If you go to the cinema, we're going to run into Real D, which is actually devised by the Walt Disney Company. We've got Dolby 3D. Greater Union Cinemas use Dolby 3D. And there's IMAX 3D.
Yep.
These are basically your big three at this point. Now, let's wrap IMAX and Real D together as a bundle because they're actually pretty much the same format. The only difference is that IMAX's screen is three stories tall and absolutely enormous. We know that. So that's a big difference. The second difference is that the Real D uses circular polarized lenses and IMAX uses linear polarized lenses. What does that do? Well, the only thing that I can find that makes a difference is the fact that they say that the linear polarizing actually seems to make images pop off the screen more. So when you actually watch an IMAX 3D film, it feels like it's coming at you. Whereas with Real D, it sets better depth of field with the circular polarizer, so it actually feels like you're looking into it. The effect is the same, except one is coming out at you, one you're looking into. And that's kind of true, because the Real D films have real depth. You feel like you're looking right down inside the screen, right? So that's kind of the only difference that I can find, the only differences I can find. So let's wrap those two together and say that the bigger difference is Dolby 3D. Dolby 3D is the cheaper alternative, and the cinemas chose to do it because there's actually a little bit less in the retooling to get Dolby 3D and as there is to get Real D. All right, so how does 3D work to start with? Well, let's go back, talk about anaglyph to start with. Anaglyph is that very old-fashioned technique. In fact, I can, for our viewers, I can demonstrate. Where are we? I forgot the cameras. That's anaglyph. Red and blue lenses. Okay, so here we go. We're going to look like a dork. Hold on. There we go. We'll do it in anaglyph. Oh, God, headache. And that's the problem with anaglyph, is the fact that it tugs on your eyeballs. Okay, you've got this red and this blue lens, and they tug on your eyeballs. The reason you've got a red and blue lens is the way they make an anaglyph 3D film is they take two images, and they superimpose those images on top of each other, slightly offset, and through two colored filters, one cyan, one red. Over time, that's kind of changed a little bit. If you look at some of the DVD releases, they're actually coming out with slightly pink, slightly green lenses. But it's the same basic concept. The idea is that the film is projected. You put on this dorky red and blue glasses. Your glasses actually counter those filters, which actually sets the two images apart from each other and kills the color change. So what you end up with is a stereoscopic image where it looks like you've got depth. It works okay, and it actually is used mostly overseas, that is. It's used mostly for things like comic books and printed pages. Works really well in that circumstance. Or on computer screens. I've actually looked at anaglyph images on a computer screen, and you can actually make them out pretty well. Polarized method came along, and what the polarized method is and in the old days, this is going back to the original, was you'd have two projectors that ran in sync with each other. Each projector had two variations of the film. They're slightly offset from each other, but they run in sync, and each one is going through a polarized lens or a circular polarized lens that are actually working in different directions. What happens is those images are projected on the screen overlapping each other. You put on your glasses, perception of persistence of vision. One lens is picking up one of the polarized images. The other lens is picking up the other polarized lens. So what you're actually doing is seeing one projector with one eye and the other projector with the other eye, and you can't actually see the other projector because of the polarized glasses. That's the whole idea. And what happens is they counter each other and you get depth. Okay, that's kind of, in a nutshell, we're talking accessible tech here. We're not going to get into real detail. But that's basically how it works. Now, why 3D? No, there is actually one more factor on that, which we must mention, which is the fact that the screen has to be changed. To get 3D, to get polarized 3D to work properly, the screen has to be really, really reflective. It has to cast a lot of light back. Standard cinema screens don't work. They need to replace the screens with what actually is a screen that is coated in silver. And that silver reflects it back like crazy. Now, even back in the 1950s, to get a 3D screen to work, it had to be a silver reflective screen. And that's how they get all that light to make that work. So to actually run one of these polarized films, you actually have to have a cinema that is equipped with two synced projectors with the polarized lenses and a silver screen. So you can imagine that it's an expensive process to put one of these screens in. I don't think Australia ever bothered to do it, quite frankly. Throughout the history of film, I don't think we've ever bothered to put in a proper 3D cinema. And so the prints that we got of these 3D films were always in anaglyph, which is the red-blue lens. Because anaglyph uses one strip of film, because it's all hard meshed onto the film. It's cheap. You can run it in any basic cinema. And so we got all those 80s bad 3D films where we went, that's not very good 3D, and it gave us headaches because we were getting all the anaglyph. In America, they were getting them in polarized lenses. So I would love to see some of these films re-released now that we are tooled up for 3D. Because with digital 3D, we have a situation where all the cinemas are starting to retool. Even the lowly little Ritz over across the road here, this little cheap cinema, put in a digital screen. And if you go to Cinema 3, I think it is, whichever, they have one digital cinema. Yeah. It's got a digital projection system and a silver screen, and it looks fantastic. It's a great digital screen and shows all the 3D films there. Mm. So it does cost to retool.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the other technique, which is the Dolby. Because the Dolby technique actually uses a combination of both the anaglyph and the polarizing. And the reason why this works is the fact they don't have to replace the screen. Mm. Now, with the Dolby system, if you actually look at the Dolby glasses, they are actually slightly pink and slightly green. Mm. They're polarized lenses,
yeah.
But they have a slight sheen to them. And the reason they do that is because they work on the polarized system, but they also have a slight color offset. The idea is that boosts the color out at you.
With the Dolby 3D ones, we're actually looking at the image into the image, or is it popping out?
I couldn't tell you. I've only seen one film in the Dolby, and I got to tell you, I actually didn't like the Dolby experience.
Yeah.
I saw Final Destination, and that might have had something to do with it. No. But my first thought when I sat down was that the image was really dark and muddy, and it felt like it was being too diffused. The glasses are darker, and it just overall, I didn't like the experience. And they're charging so much like Great Union Cinemas for the 3D experience, it's just a waste of money. I always look now for the real D screens. I actually don't even like IMAX 3D that much, and I know that's kind of sacrilegious amongst fans. Mm. But I saw Avatar at IMAX, and I actually preferred the real D projection of Avatar, because I've seen Avatar 4 times. I actually prefer the real D projection of Avatar, because the problem I found with IMAX, and I've actually read some forum posts where other people are seeing that, where it's such a big screen that it actually blurs at times. It's having trouble compensating for it, unless it's shot in that great big IMAX format, which these films aren't actually shot in IMAX format.
Yeah.
It's a little bit too big a screen for what's going on. Yeah. And it's just wasn't as satisfying as experience. Much more intimate at a real D screen to see something like Avatar. Anyway, that's personal opinion, though.
Like
Dave loves IMAX.
Yes.
That's the end of story. You know what you're saying?
I was just going to say, like, for the people that are watching this that are interested to see more 3D films, how do you actually know which certain cinemas will actually be showing the
real
3D? Or you just look at the glasses. And that's
what you do is you go ask them. If you actually look, I've got a pair of, this is from the Ritz, on the arm of the glasses. Where's my camera? On the arm of the glasses, it actually says Real D on the side. Now, the Greater Union, you can't take the glasses home.
Yeah.
Apparently, the Dolby 3D technique is actually, the glasses are much more expensive.
Mm.
And so they actually alarm code the glasses and you have to hand them in at the end of every session. Yeah. Whereas at the Ritz, what they do is they actually have promoted it that you buy the glasses for $1 and you take them home with you. The next time you come, it's $1 off the movie. You don't have to, so you can keep your glasses and you just keep bringing back your own. In America, it's become an industry. People are getting designer 3D glasses. Mm. You know, it's ridiculous, but whoops, shit, sorry. Anyway, so, all right, so we've got polarized 3D, we've got real D, we've got IMAX, we've got digital 3D. Now, here's the kicker. What is the difference between digital 3D and the original polarized 3D? That can be summed up in one word, one projector. All right, so the difference is with the old film polarized technique, you had to synchronize two projectors to run. Now, this is why most of the old 3D films of the 50s actually had an intermission, because the film only had a maximum runtime. And then once it got to the end of its runtime, they had to re-spool the two projectors simultaneously and retime them. So rather than trying to do this on the fly, which they do with a standard film, they basically would have an intermission. They could re-spool up the second half of the film, and then it would go.
Mm.
Digital projection actually allows one projector. And basically what happens is, because it can run at such a high speed, whereas a projector plays back at 24 frames a second, right? Or 24 frames a second. Yeah. With a digital projector, they can actually run that puppy at 144 frames per second. And rather than have two projectors projecting two bits of film simultaneously, what they do is they project left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye, but really fast, so you can't see it happening. So both images are actually coming out of the projector simultaneously, or one right after another in sequence. They have a circular polarizer on the front of that lens, which is actually changing, and it's actually rotating. Now, I've got a stat here. It actually says that it's going. It says the it says it's got a circular polarizing liquid crystal filter which can switch the polarity 144 times a second. And so basically, it's changing the polarity over and with the frame, so that you've got your two polarized lenses. And what's happening is you're not catching the frame changes because it's happening so fast. Yeah. But your eyes are seeing one frame, and then a left frame, and a right frame, and a left frame, and a right frame, and a left frame. And that's how they're making the wonderful digital 3D today. And I think that is such a neat piece of tech. To go on with this, basically what we look at is we say, how does digital 3D going to work on television then? Mm. You know, I mean, we look at this and we go, if it's only flicking frames over at a certain period of time, left eye, right eye, isn't that easy for television? Mm. And that's the question I'm going to put out there. 3D television is a whole different kettle of fish. We'll come back to that in a second. Anyway, so we've got three different types of 3D being shown around at the moment. We know that the polarizing technique gives us much sharper colors. It gives us much sharper picture quality. Mm. Anaglyph would give you headaches because of the two multicolored lenses. Yeah. Anaglyph is used. It is actually still used in certain regards. Some of the DVDs that have come out of films that were in 3D have come out with anaglyph glasses.
Oh, yeah. I can think of one straight away.
Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Yep. Coraline did
that. Coraline, My Bloody Valentine, which some of them don't have the 3D glasses. It was only in their initial release that they did it. I was kind of miffed that I missed the My Bloody Valentine one. It works to a degree. Yeah. It's not great. Mm. High-def TV, it works a little bit better than low-def. There is now actually a Blu-ray standard in place for Blu-ray 3D. Be very interesting to see when that actually happens. Mm. We're going to need the TVs first. What was I about to say? The anaglyph, though, when it's used at the cinema, is really used in situations where only part of the film is in 3D. Now, the reason why that is because if you're projecting a film, and we're talking about film here, so not digital, but if you're projecting a film, and let's say you're watching Friday the 13th, part, whatever it was, Freddy's Dead, which has 20 minutes of 3D just at the end of the film, you don't want to switch to dual projectors to get that last 20 minutes. What you want is you want it just to be a straight transition straight into the 3D because anaglyph can be done on one strip of film. It can all be on the one strip of film. Yeah. So they give you anaglyph glasses. It's the easiest way. It's the easiest cop-out to that, basically. Yeah. So, anaglyph does have a place. Mm. I think what you'll find, though, is that as technology moves on, anaglyph will slide further and further away. Because let's face it, if it's a digital projection of a film, what says that they couldn't ramp up the speed on the projector? Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. Okay. Have I missed anything, Shane? I'm trying to think. Did I miss anything before we move on?
No, definitely not. No?
No.
No.
Hey, everybody think they've been feeling at school at this point? Yeah. Just looking at the chat room. All right, chat room. Beardy knows his 3D stuff. I did a lot of homework. Yeah. I gotta say, I actually learned a few things. It was kind of cool. All right, so we move into conversion. How do we convert a film that was shot in 2D into a 3D film and actually make it work? You can't just throw a 2D film up onto a 3D projector. No. It doesn't work. You have to have two distinct images because our eyes converge. We have two eyes that converge, which what gives us 3D vision. So what they do is they're actually companies now that are being set up in America, and I assume other countries as well, but we look at America because they're the big 3D people, who specialize in this. And what they do is they literally digitize the entire film if it isn't already digitized. They then run it through specialist software where they actually go frame by frame through the film and break it into layers. So they'll say that rock is in the foreground, and they'll literally outline that rock and say that should be a layer. They look at the person behind it, they'll outline that person, they'll say that should be a layer. The castle in the background, circle that, that should be a layer. Yeah. Go to the next frame, do it again, next frame, do it again. If it's one static shot that doesn't change for a lot, they can get the computer to interpolate, and it will actually do a sequence for them. But if it's a really heavy action thing, they have to frame by frame it. Once they've marked it all up into all these various layers, just like in Photoshop, really, they then run it through the computer, which actually processes that into a basically an anaglyph, a two-layered film for two different cameras, and it breaks it up into those layers. Mm. It's a long process. They say that the 3D conversion can take up to crews of 30 people to actually be running this sort of stuff, and it can take months. Which makes me wonder, because I read an article about Clash of the Titans about 3 months ago that said, no, we're not going to do it in 3D. Then shortly after that, it said, we're pushing the release date to April 1st because we are going to do a 3D conversion. It seems like a really short period of time to get a 3D conversion happening.
Yeah.
Unless they were lying the first time and they were already developing a 3D conversion on it. Who knows? 3D conversion is very popular with the studios at the moment because they don't need to use specialized cameras. They can just shoot it straight on high def and basically, or even on film, as long as it's converted to a high def format.
Yeah.
They don't have to worry about any of that. They can just convert them. This is why Harry Potter can suddenly be, we're going to do a 3D conversion on it. Clash of the Titans can have a sudden 3D conversion on it. What is better? I think it's quite obvious that a film that is actually shot to be in 3D is going to be the better experience.
It's going to take less time as well. Instead of a conversion.
But you look at it and you say, a filmmaker has actually framed that shot to be in 3D. So there'll be a foreground element, there'll be background elements, there'll be midfield elements. Mm. And you'll get and go, if you shot it for 2D, you weren't thinking that way. Mm. You weren't thinking about depth. Mm. The film that really, really impressed me actually was My Bloody Valentine. I don't know if you saw it or not, but I went to see My Bloody Valentine as a preview screening, and I reviewed it on the Geek Actually movie show. We're not a movie show, so I won't go into the details of it. Stupid film, fantastic 3D. Mm. And it was the first time I had actually seen a live-action film in this new digital 3D process. And it was actually shot to be 3D. It wasn't converted, and it looked sensational. And I remember sitting there in the cinema. There's one shot in particular that stayed in my mind forever, right near the beginning of the film, where a guy is leaning against his car on a deserted road at the mouth of the mine shaft. Very simple shot. But when you're actually looking down the road, you see him sitting against his car and the road stretching off in the background. Mm. And in 3D, it has all this depth, you know. you could see right down the road, you know. And I'm looking at it going, wow, that is just remarkable. And it was at that point I fell in love with 3D. And I thought, this really is a neat tool. Mm. We're not using it as the gimmick anymore. We're not throwing things at the screen just so that things dance around in front of you. We're using it just as a tool to get depth to a shot, and that is what I'm kind of excited about.
Like what you were talking about earlier with how it takes a certain amount of people to do the conversion process, as far as each shot was done frame by frame, etc. I can kind of feel a little bit of their pain, even though I didn't do any 3D work. I actually did a little bit of mocap work, actually had me going back in keyframe to keyframe and actually adjusting each animation for that mocap work.
Well, I do a lot of work in motion and stuff, and in Flash as well. Mm. And you have to, you can use tweening animation, but there is a lot of frame by framing in there. And I use a lot of Photoshop.
Mm.
And now I can sit there and tell you that working in layers is a lot of fun, but when you think about rendering out a film as stills to work on in Photoshop, which a lot of people do, and then having to work on, I don't know, a couple of thousand frames, you sit there and go, oh, God. And when you start talking about feature film, you're talking about millions of frames, you know. Mm. It's a lot of work. I feel for them. But you know what? Somebody's got to do it.
I bet they get paid well enough as well.
Very, very true. Yeah. All right, look, we're running out of time. This day is going by so quickly. We're running out of time, but I do want to just briefly touch on 3D television. Look, 3D television is still up in the air, and there's not a lot we can report. Nothing has actually been released yet. There's a lot of prototypes kicking around. At the moment, the forerunner or the forefront person, I think, or forefront company, I think, to this, and I could be wrong about this. You probably know more about the home hardware than I do. But it seems like Sony is at the forefront of this at this point.
Yeah.
That could change. Sony's really pushing it for PlayStation.
Mm.
They really want 3D PlayStation, but 3D film as well. And because they own a motion picture company, I guess they are interested in it for that as well.
Mm.
I personally think, personal feeling, I personally think that it's stupid. I think 3D is an event thing that you go out to the cinema for and... Mm. I don't really want 3D TV. I don't want to wear dorky glasses in my living room, quite frankly. And at this point in time, yes, there isn't 3D television without glasses. There's some prototypes kicking around, but it's not going to be anytime soon.
No.
And at this point, the 3D glasses that Sony is talking about with the early prototypes are expensive because they're shutters. They're actually LCD shutter glasses, which means you have these little active shutters kicking inside to actually flick the image. I don't like that idea.
It already sounds like a headache to begin with. If you can actually hear the shutters going off while you're actually watching it.
Yeah, well, I don't think you'll hear them because I think they're LCD shutters. So I think it's an electronic process. Yeah. But still, the concept of it, I don't like. Now, there is talk about a more Real-D type format because realistically, all you need is a TV that can run it. What's the standard plasma screen running at now? Is it 100 hertz?
Oh, yeah, you can get them near like 120 now.
120? If you could actually run one of these TVs at like 500 hertz or 1,000 hertz, there's no reason why your refresh rate couldn't be fast enough that it could actually run multiple images and so forth. This is all stuff that could be developed. Mm. Still, the concept is you got to wear the dorky glasses in your living room. Yeah. Right? Nobody wants to do this. I think it's a bad idea. But more importantly, it may be a health hazard.
Yeah.
Now, I think this is probably, we'll finish up on this because we are running a little bit long, but I think it is very important. Mark Pesci, who is an American expat who now lives here, and he's given some really, really good seminars over his time about tech and so forth. He works for the ABC a lot. Well, I'm assuming he's American. He's got an accent. He could be Canadian. I could be wrong. You know, sometimes you can't tell between them. I don't know. I don't actually have his background here. But basically, he wrote an article on the Drum Unleashed for ABC's website. And he is actually as a bit of a scientist. And he worked for Sega at one point, developing VR. And he brought up some very, very interesting points. The link for this article will also be on the website when this episode is posted. But basically, he is talking about 3D, and he said that he actually doesn't think 3D cinema is a good idea. And the reason why he doesn't think 3D cinema is a good idea is because it actually leads to a disease. Now, the disease, not like your cold or flu, but it leads to a problem with your eyes. Now, I'm just trying to find where he actually calls it because it's a really good name. And if I can find the actual name of it, I'll tell you what it is here. It causes this is thrilling radio, I know. But permanent – here it is. Here it is. It causes a condition called binocular dysphoria. Now, binocular dysphoria, basically what he's saying is that when you actually – look around the world, we see in 3D. Okay, we've got two eyes and everything has depth and substance, but we actually see things in multiple fields of vision. We've got depth perception, we have peripheral vision, and so forth. When we go see a 3D movie, we put on these glasses, and even though we think we're seeing 3D, what we're actually seeing is 2D, and we're telling our brain,
we're tricking
the brain and saying it's 3D. And basically, one of the reasons why people get headaches when they watch 3D is because they're arguing with their brain. Their eyes are arguing with their brain, and that can cause a headache. Okay? Yeah. Now, what is happening when you watch a 3D movie, and this I don't mean to say any of this to scare anybody out there, but you're actually giving yourself binocular dysphoria. All right. Now, when you take off the glasses, some people snap back instantaneously. Yep. Some people it takes a couple of hours to snap back. You do snap back, but sometimes it takes a couple hours. People who don't snap back straight away are more likely to have a car accident on the way home because their depth perception is thrown out by this movie. All right. The problem with 3D TV is if we are actually watching the television with 3D glasses on for 5 to 8 hours a day or 6 hours a day, every single day, we actually may make that condition permanent.
Yeah.
We may actually be causing binocular dysphoria on a permanent basis. Now, the scariest part of all of this is the fact that he's going to back this up now with some facts. So before we sit there and go, oh, he's a crackpot. He worked for Sega.
Yeah. This is one of the things where he talks about how this ended the VR.
Yeah, basically he says here, he says, this concept of binocular dysphoria, he says, where is it? He goes on and says that this is exactly what they said to Sega. Yeah. They went to Sega after they tested and developed this for a great deal of time and basically went and told Sega, It says that's what the testers told Sega, and that's why the Sega VR system, which had been announced with great fanfare, never made it to market.
Yeah.
It basically was taken away because this VR helmet was causing exactly the same problems. Mm. Now, what they're saying, and the scariest part to all of this, is he puts in bold letters in his article, none of the television manufacturers have done any health and safety testing about this at all.
Yeah.
They're rushing into this headlong. Mm. They're going, 3D TV! They're not even bothering to look at, is there an issue that could be? And it may not be anything. Mm. We may find that it's not something that's permanent. It may be something that, you know, it's just being blown out of proportion. But the fact that there's no health and safety testing being done is a concern.
It may actually end up being like a terms and conditions that you kind of get when you throw in like a DVD that says for your own personal safety watch this movie like
the Nintendo Wii, right? You should take a break.
Make sure you take a break a day in advance.
What he actually said, though, I think this is the most telling thing about this article, is he actually ends the article by saying, one of two things is about to happen. And I love the statement. What's his name again? What did he say? Mark Pesce. Mark Pesce says, one of two things is about to happen. Either 3D television will quickly and quietly disappear from the market, from product announcements, and from broadcast plans, or we will see the biggest class action lawsuit in the planet's history as millions of children around the world realize that their televisions permanently ruin their depth perception. And he says, let's hope 3D in the home dies a quiet death.
Yeah.
I kind of agree with him, though. I do think that there is an issue. I think the new polarizing system that we use for 3D is much better on the eyes. It doesn't have the same sort of eye strain as the old anaglyph lenses do. But at the same time, you do feel a little bit dazed when you walk out of a 3D film. Suddenly you're taking these glasses off, your eyes are having to readjust. There is something happening.
Mm.
And yes, you snap out of it, but there is something happening.
Like what you were talking about before, when we were mentioning about what Sega made with the VR system, I actually remember seeing that when I was quite a bit younger.
I remember all the
arcades, and I actually saw it in action. This guy was standing on like a little standing area, and he had the VR goggles on.
The arcade versions were around for some time.
Yeah.
Yeah, the arcade versions were around. I think the version he's talking about that disappeared was the home versions.
Yes. Okay.
The arcade version, because the thing about the arcade version is you could only do it for, you know, a few minutes.
Yeah.
Coins ran out, you know?
But I remember thinking about that and going, look, it never actually went past, it never went any further than that as far as VR is concerned.
Yeah, VR kind of died in the water.
Never went anywhere.
And it was really big in the 80s. Yeah. So it's a really big thing in the late 80s through into the early 90s. Movies were made. Everybody was talking about VR. I mean, do you remember Johnny Mnemonic and all this sort of stuff? You know? And you got all these films came out, and all this talk about VR was the way it was going to happen, and then it just all disappeared. Mm. How many people did you see come off those VR platforms and kind of stumble around because their entire perception of the world was gone? Yeah. And they go, that can't be helped.
They start coming off, and they start moving their hands around going, oh. I should be holding on to something. I'm not.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I actually only ever did VR once. It was in an arcade. I actually didn't like it. I actually found once the helmet was on, I actually felt like I didn't know my spatial awareness at all.
Yeah.
And it was just bizarre. I felt really uncomfortable. It was very strange.
Also, if anybody remembers the Virtual Boy, how much of a failure that was for Nintendo.
Yes. I had
to bring that up, sorry.
Yes.
For all the Nintendo fans, sorry.
And yes, according to Psydog is outing me in the chat. Is it Psydog who's outing me? No. Bagma? Who's outing me? No, Psydog is outing me in the chat room saying that I'm a Farmville addict. All right, I'm a Farmville addict. leave me alone. Leave me alone and send me a cow.
I get enough people asking me mafia requests.
Oh, and I get those all the time. Look, I'm going to say this on the record. I play Farmville and I play Cafe World. Do not send me requests for any other games. I'm not interested. But I am accepting horses in Farmville if you want to be my neighbor. All right. We're going to get ourselves out of here. We got a little bit of housekeeping just to tidy up the show. We're actually running a little bit over today. All right. So we're going to a little bit of housekeeping. First of all, if you agree, disagree, found it interesting, or hated it, please send us email at geektech@geekactually.com. That's our personal email address here, and that will bypass Geek Actually and platforms and get it straight to us. Or you can leave us a voicemail at Sydney number 02-8011-3167. Love to hear your feedback on this episode in particular. Do you want more educational ones like this, or do you want us to talk more about censorship and stuff? Tell us which direction you want us to go. We will steer in that direction. You can buy Geek Actually merchandise, including the platforms, and soon Geek Actually tech, stuff like t-shirts, mugs, mouse mats, etc. Go to cafepress.com.au/geekactually. And we are still looking for people to take that survey. It's the survey from hell, I know, but it really will help us out with advertising. If you go to geekactually.com/support-us, you'll see the link at the top of the Geek Actually page. First option is to take a survey. That is actually the PodTrack survey, and that'll really help us a lot if you can take that to try and match us up with some advertisers. That's across the board, all shows. All right. We also want to put a quick shout-out to a couple of people here. First of all, fellow podcasters, Real Junkies, the podcast, movie podcast, which is fueled by tequila, as I like to say. You can find them at weekendronin.com, or you can search for them on iTunes. It's a really fun podcast. And our other friends, Movie Fan House Podcast, which you can find at moviefanhouse.com, which they've recently redesigned, and it's a fantastic website. Really, really good stuff. Now, the more important at this point, or the slightly more important one at this point, is our friends over at PALGN. PALGN, is it .com.au? Yeah, .com.au. They are teaming up with the retail chain of Game, continuing on about the R18 plus rating for games. Now, the submissions for the discussion paper closed on the 28th, but PALGN and Game are continuing to take entries anyway because they continually want the government to know that there is still support on this. Now, you can pop into any game store and actually fill in the form at the counter and let your voice be heard, or you can shoot over to everyoneplays.org.au, www.everyoneplays.org.au, and there is a link to this at geekactually.com, and you can have your voice heard there as well. The R18 plus rating is not something that's just going to go away or fix itself. It needs your help. If you want to support this, get in there and support it. Okay, that's our plugging for everybody. If you want to join us in the chat room or watch us live, we do go out every Wednesday at 8 p.m. ish. 8 p.m. ish. And you can find us at geekactually.com/live. That's Australian Eastern Daylight Savings Time for the moment. We also run two other podcasts, which are the Geek Actually podcast, which is our movie show, our longstanding movie show on Saturdays at 12 p.m. and our riotous, raucous gaming podcast, which goes out every Monday at 8 p.m. called Platforms, which is definitely not one for the children. And if we had an R18 plus rating, we'd probably carry it. But it's also a lot of fun and has a very active chat room, so you are welcome. And all of these can be also found as audio podcasts on iTunes and at the website geekactually.com. Excuse my scraping of the microphone there. I think that's everything. I think we have covered everything. Unless there's anything, where can people find out more about you, Shane?
If you want to find out more about me, just go on to, I guess you can look me up on Facebook either by typing in Nexus81. That's probably the easiest way to get a hold of me.
Are you another Facebook slut where you take everybody as a friend?
That would probably be the main page. It'd have my full name on the page or Nexus81.
I know that Dave always says he's a Facebook slut. Anybody who asks for friends, he'll be friends with them. I'm pretty much the same way, I got to tell you. Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, I think we're going to get out of here. If you want to follow me personally, you can follow me at facebook.com/David McVeigh or on twitter.com/David McVeigh. We often put up our posts and so forth. We also have a Geek Actually fan page, facebook.com/GeekActually. Send us a story or something. It'll be very interesting. We'll try and get it on the show for you. Otherwise, I think that's it. Are we finished? We're finished. Just remember out there, we're the geeks, so you don't have to be, and we try and do it as accessible as possible. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll talk to you more next week. Bye now.